they're making them 70 grand.
It's the fat of the city.
Heavy. Welcome, everyone, to the Senate Committee on Business, Transportation, and Economic Development. This is going to be our land use day, and so we've got a number of bills we're going to discuss, and I am going to turn this over to you and get on and start it.
Can I hit the gavel?
Yeah, you're opening the public hearing. Hit it really hard.
I will when you sit down. I'm trying to.
Open the public hearing on Senate Bill 771-766-476 and 792. Would you like to give us an opening comment there before we turn over to the chair?
Sure. I will just let you know that we have no revenue impact on any of these bills, but we have not received any word from fiscal on these bills, so we don't have a fiscal impact. And 771 and 792 are identical in language.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, for the record, I'm Lee Beyer. I'm Senator from Central Lynn and Lynn Counties. And what you have before you today is our start of working on some land use bills. And I like to put it in context and say that for me, when I chose to run for the legislature again, the one thing that I said repeatedly in my campaign was what I wanted to do is make sure that Oregon was positioned for growth as we come out of this recession. And one of the features of that, obviously, is land. Without the land to build some of the industrial plants on, we won't get those jobs. And without those jobs, we won't have the income necessary to provide for education and the other vital services that are serious to us. One of the things that I'd note is I've been involved at the local level in land use for, gosh, almost 25, 30 years now. And I'm a strong proponent of the Oregon land use system as envisioned in 1973 in Senate Bill 100. I think it has worked well for most of that period of time, and it was envisioned to be an evolutionary process. However, we're well beyond the 20-year timeline of most of those plans, and we've exhausted most of the land supply, particularly with regard to industrial lands. What the bills that you're going to hear about today do is try to address that problem. And I would suggest to you as we work these bills that we'll probably be changing them, and we'll probably decide whether we want to try and push out one comprehensive bill, hopefully at least one bill, or a number of different bills. You'll hear different versions of that today. I would like to acknowledge that this process started during the last interim, led by Senator Edwards and Representatives Klim and Gillum over on the House side. They did a lot of work, which I joined their group back in after the election, or right before the election, I guess. And the product that we worked on the most with the work group is Senate Bill 766. Senator Starr has also been involved, along with Senator Telfer, in doing some more pilot projects. So I think there's a lot of good pieces that are here. What I hope we can do is collectively, as a committee, as a legislature, and as a state, has come together, in at least in the short term, to try and make sure that we have some jobs available for our children and our neighbors. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll turn it back over, and I believe Senator Telfer is in the audience and wants to testify.
Thank you. Is there any questions for the strong component? Thank you. Senator Telfer.
And I have brought friends.
And friends.
And friends.
Senator Telfer.
Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Atkinson, and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to come before you today. I am Senator Chris Telfer from sunny Central Oregon, District 27. And let me explain to you a little bit why I say, sunny doesn't need an explanation, but Central Oregon. While I reside in Bend, population of approximately 77,000, based on the census, 20 minutes to the north of me is the city of Redmond, the second largest city in my district at a population of about 30,000. To the west, about another half an hour, is the city of Sisters, which is the third largest city in my district at 1,700 people, roughly. Another half an hour north of Redmond in the district, the county of Jefferson County, which is Senator Farioli's district, is a city by the name of Madras. And about another half an hour mile east, half an hour trip east of Redmond is a city called Prineville, and it's approximately 12,000 in population. It is in Senator Whitsitt's district. And I say this because we in that Tri-County area consider most of what we do on a regional basis. You know, all of our nonprofits, our social services are based on a regional approach within the Tri-County area. Our economic development is a regional basis. Economic development of Central Oregon, what we call EDCO, is a driving force there. In fact, such a driving force that the governor and I are going to spend Monday there doing some things, as well as meeting with them and attending their annual luncheon. So it's a very regional-based approach to economic development. I would also note that Redmond, and I have the mayor of Redmond sitting next to me here, is the fastest-growing city in Oregon right now. The Tri-County area of Jefferson County, Crook County, and Deschutes County were the three counties that grew the most in the last 10 years in the state of Oregon. It also has the highest unemployment rate in the state. Those three counties have the highest unemployment rate. And so it's critical that we continue moving forward with economic development. Senate Bill 792 is an attempt to look at some economic development opportunities on a regional basis. And what we're looking for in this bill is predominantly some flexibility in land use so that we can, in fact, approach things on a regional basis. So that's pretty much the 50,000-foot view of the bill. I'm going to turn it over to Mayor Endicott and then turn it over to some other staff people to get into some more of the details of the bill.
Thank you very much, Senator. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Vice Chairman, and members of the committee. My name is George Endicott. I'm the mayor of Redmond. And with that eloquent introduction by our senator, I'll give you a little more detail. She stole some of my thunder, but that's perfectly fine. I wish to address three items today to try and set the context for some of the testimony that will be following by our community development director, Ms. Heather Richards, and then Mr. David Brandt, our city manager. First item is need. Central Oregon continues to be the most economically depressed area in Oregon. Our unemployment rate for the region continues to hover around 15% to 20%. We're in an area that is overly dependent upon tourism and housing construction. As residents have lost their jobs, they love the area and stay. We must do all we can to meet the state's goals of economic development and job creation. Second item is land. Large lot industrial development is an important feature we're trying to create for the region. A distinct advantage we have is a plethora of publicly owned acreage. The reason it's important is because public entities can more easily hold onto land for extended periods while waiting for appropriate opportunities to develop. And finally, the last area is regulatory infrastructure, and you heard the senator discuss that a little bit. Central Oregon has a history of regional cooperation and collaboration. The Central Oregon Cities Organization, COCO, is a common focus group consisting of the nine area cities. The Central Oregon Advisory Council on Transportation, otherwise known as COACT, has state organizations, county and city government representatives, and other interested parties, including federal agencies, participate collectively to identify issues and reach common agreement on transportation issues. All proposals from Central Oregon concerning Connect Oregon 1, 2, and 3 have been consensus applications from COAC to ODOT. Finally, the Deschutes bodies are members of the Deschutes Water Alliance and is a consensus building group that addresses water issues in the basin. All affected bodies participate, from the Warm Springs Confederated Tribes to all governmental bodies, all water and irrigation districts. The purpose of pointing this out is to demonstrate a long history of being able to provide a regional infrastructure where decisions can be made locally and the state can have some assurance that this model will continue for land use issues. I will now ask our community development director and our city manager to discuss the details of our suggested amendments to the reference bills. Thank you very much for attention, and if you'll indulge me, I'll swap places here with Mr. Brandt.
Good afternoon, Chair and Vice Chair and committee members. I'm Heather Richards, the Community Development Director for the City of Redmond. I have been a member of a regional advisory committee in Central Oregon that's been working on a large lot industrial sites economic opportunity analysis pilot project with the Department of Land Conservation and Development for the past year. So specific to what's in Senate Bill 792 and 771, the Regional Economic Plan. The Regional Advisory Committee is comprised of representatives from the Tri-County area that Senator Telfer referenced, Central Oregon, Deschutes, Jefferson, and Crook counties, as well as members of all the jurisdictions in those three counties and special interest groups. And our dialogue has been very informative, it's been very collaborative, and we're very supportive of the bill that you have in front of you today, because that supports the efforts of what we've been discussing for the past year in terms of where we feel there are some deficiencies currently in our land use process to support economic development in the state of Oregon and also regionally in our region of Central Oregon. The intent of this bill to support an inventory of large lot employment sites that will serve both regional and statewide needs for economic development efforts, we feel is critical for Oregon in both the near term and the long term. I wanted to visit with you a little bit today about what we are doing in Central Oregon, and our recommendation is actually to amend the bill to insert a pilot project that's specific to our region, since we are working on this pilot project for the regional economic plan with DLCD right now. We expect to have the plan finished by the end of this fiscal year. That plan will include not only what we consider site criteria for these opportunity sites, but also a regional advisory council that will administer how these sites are put into the inventory and how to replace inventory as needed. It will also look at a model code for large lot industrial users. So we feel that at the end of this fiscal year, we will be in a position to serve as a successful pilot program for this bill as implemented moving forward. You've heard about the need in Central Oregon. You've heard about how we cooperate regionally and how we're all working together in terms of this effort for this pilot program, and we're very supportive of your efforts in that regard. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair, committee members. I want to, I think you have a map that we set up to you. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm David Brown. I'm the city manager of the city of Redmond. I want to talk to you a little bit about with respect to the City of Redmond on the ground, how the regional economic opportunity analysis has brought two sites to the fore, which we think legislation pending before this committee would assist. The first is we have 462 acres within our UGB, which is owned by the Redmond School District, the Central Oregon Irrigation District, and Deschutes County jointly, which is fully served, ready to go, would be large lot industrial, except that it doesn't qualify under our local economic opportunity analysis, nor does it comply with TPR. In addition, there are 912 acres just south of our UGB, which is owned by the Department of State Lands, which for similar reasons also would qualify, and it's, again, prime acreage for large lot industrial. These two sites together probably would be, if they were approved and appropriately zoned, the probably two largest sites in the state of Oregon for this kind of development. Thank you.
Has a question? Thank you. The $64,000 question for any city, especially given your growth, do you have the sewer and water capacity to handle a major development.
We do for the, especially for the 462-acre site off of Highway 126, we have adequate sewer and adequate water for that.
To follow up on that, too, as part of our year-long process for this regional economic opportunity analysis, we are looking at the need for engineering feasibility studies for these sites. We've actually looked at these two sites specific to that, and that's why they are currently being positioned as prime sites within our regional process right now as well, because they are served with capacity.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the folks from the City of Redmond, do you know if the project that you're working on with DLCD right now, is that part of the DLCD's local grants program? And maybe you don't know. I saw people from DLCD here earlier. Maybe they could just nod their head yes.
Yes.
Okay.
It's a technical assistance program.
Okay. Thank you.
What's the impact of the current TPR language on this?
In which bill?
Well, I'm just talking about in terms of your testimony said with the land you have problems with the existing TPR.
Yes. Currently, the 462 acres within our UGB are zoned open space, even though there's no open space use of the property. It would be already zoned industrial if not for the TPR, which it doesn't comply with, and also that we can't justify it under our local economic.
How does it not comply with the transportation planning rule?
It would require some improvements at the intersection of US 97 and 126.
How far a distance is that?
About a quarter of a mile.
Other questions?
One quick question.
Yes, Senator Atkinson.
Senator Telfer, is there a similar large piece of land being discussed to come in South Bend, southern portion of Bend?
Come into?
Into the UGB?
Mr. Chair, Senator Atkinson, it's in the north side of Bend, part of what we call Juniper Ridge. There's 1,500 acres that the city owns, of which approximately 500 acres is already in the UGB. About 200 acres more have been designed to be brought into the UGB for housing, higher education, et cetera, and industrial land.
How much industrial?
Oh boy. Let's see, I'm trying to go back to my city council days. It has changed a little bit. It's a lot of mixed use. There's 1,500 acres, 6,000 home sites eventually, but the rest of it, 200 acres for higher education, and the rest of it's all commercial and industrial.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And, okay, Mr. Whitman, I see him here somewhere. Richard, would you?
He's bolting for the door.
I was going to call you up and let you do an overview. Since you've been sort of the...
I'm out of here.
Well, you may not acknowledge it, the head facilitator of the work group, which we very much appreciate.
Thank you.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Richard Whitman. I am the governor's natural resource advisor and, until very recently, the director of DLCD. I've been working for the past several months, as you know, with a group of interest on potential changes to the industrial development part of our land use system to assure a couple of things in this very difficult economic environment that we're in right now. One, first of all, to address issues in terms of permitting of industrial projects that are important in terms of jobs. And then to assure that where we do have lands in the state of Oregon that are regionally significant in terms of their long-term potential for industrial jobs, that we are preserving those areas to maintain that potential for long-term job growth. So, Senator, I'm here today to talk at a high level about the work that we're doing in that work group. And so I'm going to go into those concepts in just a little bit more detail. First of all, on the permitting side, the concepts that we are working on are to expedite both state and local permitting of significant new employment projects in the state. And to do that by convening basically a group of the agencies that are involved in permitting and also with input from local government to have a team that is drawn together to work through permitting issues on these projects and get to a yes or no answer very quickly. This concept is very similar to a concept that has been used in the state of Washington, legislation there. That's been part of the model. It's also modeled on a couple of other expedited permitting things that we do here in the state. So a couple of important principles to talk about here. First of all, local input and local sign-off on this. Your entry into this expedited permitting would have a couple of conditions attached to it. And first and foremost, it could not occur unless the governing body of the local government was on board with doing this sort of expedited permitting. But if you get a green flag from local government, then this siting team would convene and within 120 days of getting a complete application would work through both local land use permitting and state permitting for the project and issue what's called a project order or project certificate that would then give the yes or no answer to the developer of that project. This is not something that would be done for every project. Again, this is projects of state significance, so we're talking about significant employment potential. We're talking about significant capital investment projects. The thinking is this would be probably something on the order of 10 to 15 projects in a biennial period that would go through this sort of process. The other real benefit of this process in terms of getting jobs on the ground quickly is in terms of judicial review. Right now in our land use system, we do have a relatively expedited process in terms of land use. But still, it can take, if there is a project that's controversial, it can take a year to get through, or sometimes even longer, to get through the permitting process. This concept that we're working on also would provide that if there is an appeal of this decision on a certificate, that it would go through a very fast-track judicial review process that would get to a decision from our Court of Appeals in a matter of 3 or 4 months. So the whole thing is designed, again, to get to a yes or no very quickly. A couple of other things to mention. This is not about waiving existing standards. So existing local land use standards would not be waived through this process. You'd have to come in and show that you comply with them. Same thing with the permitting on the state permits. You'd have to show that you meet those existing standards. So those are the broad contours of what we're working on at this point. This would be a significant I think innovation in the state permitting system, bringing all of that regulatory review together in one place and getting a decision very quickly. I do need to talk just briefly about the mechanics of how this would be paid for, because I suspect that question might be going through some of your minds. It would be, right now the discussion is that it would be largely fee-based. So these projects that we're talking about are big projects, fairly capital-intensive, and they would have to pay the cost of going through this expedited review process. There would be a fee for that. It would be voluntary on their part. They would not have to do it, but if they want to go through this door to a fast process, they would have to be willing to pay the fee for that. So I'm going to pause there and see if there are any questions from the committee. This is the first part of the concept.
Richard, do you want to just touch on the review process, the judicial review?
Chair Beyer, I'll touch very briefly on both the review process at the administrative level and then the judicial review part also. The review process at the administrative level would be done by a council of five agencies, making up a review council, and the agencies that would be involved in that would be Business Oregon, which would be sort of the administrative home for this effort, if you will, the Oregon Department of Transportation, the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality, the Oregon Department of State Lands and the Oregon Department of Land Conservation and Development. So those five agencies being the, if you will, the development agencies of the state and also the main regulatory agencies of the state sitting in one council. And they would make the decision as to whether or not the project meets existing standards or not. Their decision, once it's made, could be appealed. The appeal would not be to the Land Use Board of Appeals or through some other process. It would go direct to the Oregon Court of Appeals. And as I alluded to, one of the major benefits for developers from this process would be that the basis for overturning the council's decision would be quite limited. This is based on some existing law that we have for a similar concept that was put in place back in the early to mid-90s for residential projects within urban areas. There is an expedited review process for that as well, where a decision is made by a hearing officer, basically a technical decision. It can get appealed, but only to the Oregon Court of Appeals, and the only basis for overturning it, the hearings officer's decision and the council's decision in this case, would be quite narrow, that the decision's unconstitutional or that there had been some significant abuse of process or, frankly, fraud in the review process. And that's basically it. So the notion is that we need to get these projects on the ground. We need to get to a yes or no decision quickly, and this would be the process for doing that.
And the sunset?
Yes, thank you, Chair Beyer. This is not a big new state bureau. I mean, part of the idea here is this is in reaction to very particular economic circumstances that we see ourselves in. So this system would stay in, it would be a minimum of bureaucracy, if you will, and it would go away when our unemployment rate for the state returns down to a level, right now we're talking about 6%, then this process would end, and the system that's put in place would unwind, and we would go back to our normal system.
Senator Gerard?
Thank you, Chair Barr. The question I have is, I have 18 little cities. They're all kind of, to find a big site, they probably have to expand the UGB. Is there any assumptions in your bills or anything that will allow the expansion of the UGB? Now, Redmond gave us the example, Division of State Lands. We could do a project on a Division of State Lands if they could get that inside the UGB. Or is this are you going to try to do this criteria ignoring the UGB, which could create a little bit of a firestorm with some land use groups? But I'm just trying to figure out where you're going to go with the UGB.
Okay. Chair Beyer, Senator Gerard, this process, and what I've described so far is the first element of this concept, is focused within existing urban growth boundaries, except that it would also apply to lands that are planned and zoned already for industrial use outside of urban growth boundaries. The legislature back in, I believe it was 2003, passed some legislation authorizing basically existing industrial lands outside of urban growth boundaries to be used for new projects. And this, recognizing that, this would apply to those lands as well. But it is not, this part of what we're talking about is not talking about urban growth boundary expansions. The Central Oregon project that you just heard about, that the Department of Land Conservation and Development has been helping with and helping fund, would be a UGB expansion project. The notion there is to allow, if you will, a regional determination of need rather than a city-by-city determination of need, as was described, to allow that as a basis for a UGB expansion. It's a slightly different concept.
Senator Starr?
So on the second concept, Senate Bill 771, and has LCD weighed in on that as it relates to support or oppose or neutral or needs work or you have thoughts on that?
Chair Beyer, Senator Starr, to my knowledge, DLCD has not weighed in substantively on that bill at this point. We have had discussions in the work group about this notion of a possible pilot project and possibly having some legislation that would assure that the pilot could work. And those discussions, I think, are continuing. And Central Oregon is a possible pilot, would be a potential location of that. But to my knowledge, the department has not taken a position on 771, or I believe it's 792.
Right. Thank you. Thank you.
Any other questions for Richard?
If I could, Senator Beyer, there is one other big part of the bill which speaks to issues in some other communities, and that is the notion of regionally significant industrial areas. Again, the notion is that there would be a limited number of these areas identified. The basis would be that they have unique locational advantages in terms of job creation, either in terms of infrastructure or in terms of other site care, port, marine facilities, depending on the particular area, proximity to labor, a variety of things. A certain number, minimum number of those areas would be designated by this council within a two-year period and then perhaps additional areas after that. We are also talking about the ability of local governments to nominate additional sites into that process. The designation as a regionally significant industrial area would do two things. First of all, it would provide some additional limitations, protections on what uses could be allowed in that area to assure that the area is truly maintained for high-value employment, primarily traded sector employment. But secondly, it also would, at least for the land use permitting, also authorize an expedited land use review, not just for the significant big projects, but for all industrial development within those areas would go through a fast-track review process to expedite new job creation in those areas as well. And again, we're looking at the entry into that being both sites that are designated by the state and sites that could be nominated at least at the local government level. So those are the two main concepts that this work group has been working on. I think we're making good progress in the work group. There have also, back to Senator Starr's question, been discussions about a possible pilot. That's been some of the discussion in this work group as well.
Senator Starr and Senator Jones.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. It's my understanding you followed this along through all the working, all the meetings and all that, correct? In your various capacities.
Chair Beyer, Senator Starr, I am trying to facilitate this discussion both in my past capacity and then continuing on in my current capacity.
So, and you may not, there may be others in the room that have the answer to this question, but has there been a list of properties that have been identified that are within an urban growth boundary that this would this bill would help to facilitate or expedite the development of? I mean, where I live, this isn't going to help us, really. Not a lot. I mean, Western Washington County, Hillsborough, in particular, teams to get their act together, and you know, and our issue is we don't have the supply, and so we need a process of expedited sure. expansion of the urban growth boundary. But having said that, so are there other areas in the state or in the metro area? I mean, do we have a list of properties that are, say, you know, this is going to help, and here's what they are, and you know, give me a sense of that answering that question.
All right, Chair Beyer, Senator Starr. First of all, I can't resist in talking about Metro for in your part of the state. The important thing there is to complete the reserves process and then complete an urban growth boundary expansion this year. And I believe that Metro and Washington County are on track to get that done. That will result, that is planned to result in some significant new employment lands in that part of the state. So that's part of the answer. More specifically to your question, we do not have a specific set of projects or sites at this point in mind for this process. We all use examples from time to time of possible sites or projects that this might apply to, but at this point there certainly is no list.
Thank you, Senator Girard.
Thank you, Chair Barr. I always like to say that I have the opposite district of Senator Starr. Mm-hmm. I have a rural district with 18 little cities. The city of Mill City, for example, the average wage up there is $28,000. So they would cry for anything. And we have economic development categories up through there and whatever. Is there going to be anything? Go back a little bit. The city of Redmond made the case, look, we have high unemployment. We have high unemployment up the canyon, and we also have low wages. And so is there going to be any priority given to those regions that really have an economic demand or need?
Chair Beyer, Senator Girard, the legislation is designed to allow designation or a number of significant projects around the state in terms of putting projects of state significance through the first part of this concept. It is going to be driven by the market. You're going to need to have an actual project and somebody who has a real project to put through this process. So that's on the first part of the bill. In terms of the sites of regional significance, there I think there's more of an opportunity to look at some regional distribution and balance in terms of how those are identified around the state.
Senator Edwards?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to put on the record for everybody watching that as we began this process, certainly concerns like Senator Starr has were brought up. And, land use policy, in my view, is kind of like religion in Oregon. And you've got this side and you've got this side and just at intractable odds. And which I think is one reason why, until this session, I've never enjoyed working on land use. So what we were looking for is where are some things that we can agree on. And we certainly, we teased out a lot of issues. We had, I think a list of 50-some items that we could work on, and then we worked on certain ones where we thought that we could get some traction and get something done this session. So, certainly significant issues that aren't dealt with in these proposals, but that's what got us here. So,
questions? Thank you, Richard. Richard has done an incredible job of being very calm with a large work group and keeping this moving forward. So, really appreciate that.
Thanks.
It ain't over.
I know.
It just got me.
Well, thank you. We've got a number of others who have been working on this and want to testify. We'll start off with a panel of Tom Gallagher, Jeremy Rogers, Mr. Birch, and who else?
Drake
somebody
Birch.
Else.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tom Gallagher, and I represent Portland Business Alliance. With me is Jeremy Rogers, who represents the Oregon Business Council, and Drake Butch, also with PBA. This is a make a few comments. Richard did a good job of overlaying where we are with Senate Bill 766, and from our perspective, we're also very interested in the bills that the City of Bend and the Central Region has brought forward. I think both of those projects or directions have a lot of viability. Jeremy's going to talk a little bit about what they discovered in the Oregon business plan about land use being one of the biggest obstacles to economic development, not because there's anything wrong with a land use, having a land use system, just there's not enough industrial land available, and the process of designating or determining moving urban growth boundaries is way too long, way too expensive, and way too political. It would be very unfair to say that it's just a problem with the land use. There's also a huge problem with infrastructure investment and infrastructure funding for almost any of these projects. So as we try to move out of this recession, we do face some significant challenges both on the economic side and on the process side. We support 766 as a framework to begin to move forward in the Portland area. I'm going to pass this map up to you. I'll only have one copy. I'll let you look at it after I leave. It's the Portland Harbor, and it lists the companies that are in the Portland Harbor, 5,500 acres of some of the best prime industrial land in the state. This is the kind of land that we believe would meet the qualifications of regionally significant. The processes that go on after that, most of this land has been industrial land since they started the land use process. The problem is infringement into the area of industrial land. That land has brownfields on it. It's very difficult to develop. It's land that we think 766 in the process inside of 766 would begin to protect through this designation of regionally significant. We think there's a couple of things that we need to add to whichever of the bills we move forward. We have to look at the loss of environmental land through local conditions like environmental overlays and other protections that happen. We have to look at the way in which we begin to add additional lands that may or may not be available currently inside of the urban growth boundary, and what we do to prevent the change of the comprehensive rezoning of the existing industrial land. And we'll be coming forward to this committee and the work group with some ideas and some amendments on that to work with. With that, let me let Jeremy talk about what happened in the Oregon business plan.
Great, thank you. Senator Beyer, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today on industrial lands. I am Jeremy Rogers. I'm the project manager for the Oregon Business Plan, which is a statewide effort of several business associations in the state. That we partner with key boards and commissions, economic development groups, chambers of commerce to develop a roadmap for growing Oregon's economy. When we first started the business plan in 2002, industrial lands was a big priority. And the Governor Kulongoski came in to office and led an effort around certified sites, increasing the number of certified sites. We put up the Oregon Prospector website to allow companies to find industrial land. And we made some headway, but what we learned as we traveled around the state this year, we held about 19 meetings in regions all over the state, was that most of the low-hanging fruit is gone, and that most communities in the state are facing serious issues with industrial lands. And as Tom mentioned, there's a series of issues. One is ensuring that we have an adequate short-term supply of industrial land. Another issue is that we ensure that the land we have identified as industrial land is not converted and doesn't have encumbrances upon it that prevent it from being used as industrial land. Another issue is the regulatory issues and permitting processes around the land and how quickly they can be put to use. And another is around infrastructure. Different issues in different communities, but from what I've read so far of the 766 and the 771, 792, I think that elements of each of these bills address a lot of these issues, the working group that's been working on this includes a lot of stakeholders. I think probably a group of stakeholders that maybe has never been working together on these issues before, and I'm very encouraged by the ability to move something forward this year. And, our focus for the business plan is really on traded sector industries, those companies that sell their products outside of the state, bring in new dollars that help buoy the economy. 30 years ago when we implemented our land use system, we had a lot of visionary leaders who really kind of understood the importance of forestry and agriculture to our economy, and therefore created a land use system that helped protect those lands and has done so very, very well. We're in an environment today where Oregon industries, you know, metals manufacturing, clean technology, high technology, food processing, these industries are core to Oregon's future. They pay high wages. They bring fresh dollars into the state, and Oregon has the opportunity to excel in these industries. And I think we need to approach the issue of industrial lands with the same kind of vigor that we did with farm and forest lands, not making a choice between the two, because farm and forest lands are still incredibly important to our economy, and those industries are driving quality jobs all across our state. But I don't think that we've so far done a good enough job of focusing on industrial lands in the same way. And I think, you know, with the concepts in 766 and 792 and, you know, amendments and discussions that are going on and taking place, I think that we can get to a place where we make significant progress this session. I appreciate this committee taking on this issue.
Chairman Beyer, members of the committee, I'm Drake Butch. I'm actually with, not with the Portland Business Alliance, but with a group called the Coalition for a Prosperous Region, which is really a conglomerate of groups like the Portland Business Alliance. Includes industrial groups, NAOP, Home Builders Association of Portland, and several others that have basically come together to say, we're willing to grab at any pieces of this that we believe will bring more and more industrial land, and with that, more jobs to the region. One of the biggest concerns we've had is not with really, there's been a flag raised of the lands are being lost to conversion to other uses. And I think what we found is that that's not truly the case. And I think this bill will touch on and hopefully get to some of that. The real concern that exists for us is more of a conversion that occurs through regulation. And that would be things like E-zones, or, as a matter of fact, I just heard today of Prineville having an antelope overlay zone in their industrial areas. That those things don't become the tool that inhibits the use of those lands. So the goal is really to end up with no net loss of those lands that exist already inside of an urban growth boundary. So it's about using the ones we have now better rather than being so worried about adding more all the time. Not that that's not another issue that should be done outside of 766. We also want to point out that there is a statewide significance here, that there is a role for you, that because I know how hard that is to tell local governments, we believe there's a role for the state that's going to kind of roll over you in some cases. And I think there is one in this case. I think we've seen that through these local regulations, that there is a statewide significance, and that by prioritizing some of these pieces that way, that then we'll be able to say, okay, these few pieces have that significant of a value that we're going to have a statewide process that allows to go forward and go forward faster. So in those concepts, we're very supportive of 766 and hope to participate in that process.
Thank you. Any questions, Ms. Spen? Thank you, gentlemen. Mary Kyle McCurdy, Annette Price, and Sean Gillian.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. My name is Mary Kyle McCurdy, Policy Director for 1000 Friends of Oregon. We're here in support of Senate Bill 766. We were part of the work group that Senator Edwards referred to, a diverse group that don't always agree on everything, but we decided to be guided by several principles on which we do agree. First of all, there are certain types of existing industrial lands that are irreplaceable due to their location or the infrastructure investment that the public has made in them, in things such as rail lines, freeway interchanges, and pipes in the ground or port facilities. We should protect those industrial lands for industrial uses and streamline the process to locate industrial uses on those lands. And there's a significant need to focus on those lands that are already zoned for industrial use. We need not and should not, in this bill, get into those issues where there will not be common ground, such as urban growth boundary issues. There's enough to do where there is common ground. and therefore this bill does not change or override existing law. We support this bill because it's true to those principles that brought that group together and because it does a few other things. It focuses on economic development. Industrial jobs on the whole pay higher wages and generate more spin-off employment than other types of jobs. The areas likely to be designated as regionally significant industrial areas or to be sites for projects of statewide significance are those where there's been a tremendous amount of public economic activity that's already occurred through investment in transportation and other infrastructure. And we think the public should reap the full benefit of those investments through industrial development. Some of these lands are likely to be areas that once supported industrial jobs but now have empty buildings or brownfields. And they also have existing private investment. We think we should bring employment back to those lands first. Those industrial lands that are likely to be designated through this process also are likely to be located closer to where people already live, including those who are currently out of work. That allows easier access to jobs, including via transit, walking, and bicycling. And also because this bill protects industrial lands on both sides of the urban growth boundaries. This is referred to a little bit earlier, but I just want to emphasize that agriculture is Oregon's number two industry, and it depends on lands that are not being outsourced, and it produces products that aren't being produced in other places. One out of eight jobs in this state, according to the Oregon Department of Agriculture, is agriculture-related, and the industry is directly and indirectly linked to about $22 billion in the sale of goods and services, accounting for 15% of the state's total sales of all industry sectors and its traded sector. 80% of the agricultural products produced in Oregon leave the state. 40% leave the country. Those are new dollars coming in. Those are not going to be outsourced. So we think this bill is a good bill because it protects industrial lands on both sides of the UGV. Thank you.
Senator Beyer, members of the committee, my name is, for the record, Annette Price. I'm the State Affairs Manager for the Port of Portland, and at the risk of trying not to be flip, what she said, we share a lot of the same values that our friends of, that are friends with thousands of friends.
1,001.
1,001. we believe that this bill has, and the discussions around this bill that Senator Beyer and Senator Edwards began this past interim, is a vitally important discussion about industrial land and one that has been needed to have happened for years in this state. We've got to have large parcels available for development. And at the Port of Portland, we're down to put a finer point on this, we are down to two large parcels left, and we are looking to have transactions, meaning sales, activity on those two parcels this year. We're done. We are looking at some of the sites that Mary Kyle mentioned in brownfields, you know, vacant lands, lands that have buildings on them. We're hoping to turn dirt, but the final point of this state depends on the industrial lands, not just in the Portland area, but throughout the state. This discussion has put a finer point on that very need. One of the most important issues from our perspective, you may have heard about our Troutdale Reynolds Industrial Park. That process and getting that developed and thus FedEx Ground to locate there was an extremely lengthy process. We have had discussions in our work group about the patient developer, which the Port of Portland has been over the years, in cleaning up sites and getting them ready for development, for private development. And finally, we have two additional points. One, we've got to look at the permitting process. For example, out at Troutdale Reynolds Industrial Parks, it takes us 2 years for wetlands permitting. We think we can do better than that. And then finally, we have got to establish criteria that allows for sites of regional and statewide significance to be a part of the traded sector economic development strategy. Let me say it again, the economic development strategy in this state. And that's something that's our book of business at the Port of Portland. It's economic development strategy. It's supporting our friends in agriculture and the traded sector industries. And again, I'd like to applaud you and this committee for taking up this somewhat difficult but very important discussion on industrial lands. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Jillians, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. I'll just mirror a few of the comments from my colleagues about how important Senate Bill 766 is in moving us forward economically. I think you heard from former Director Whitman some of the benefits that are in there, and number one being the expedited permitting there. In the development side, delays are very, very costly, if not fatal, to projects, and this is a huge step forward. When I speak to our commercial guys and they're looking at people coming into the state, the perception out there is that we are not a very friendly place and that we are costly in our delays. And I can tell you that, real or not, perception is reality. And a bill like this saying that, in fact, Oregon does have this process, you can get in, you have a limited appeal, is a very, very significant. Senator Edwards has been participating in the work group, and I think framed it very well in that we're very diverse in our opinions in the work group. Some of us would love to go a lot farther than this bill goes. Some of us are probably pushed to our comfort level in this bill, and I think that's about where we should be, as is always the case with land use decisions and land use bills. I would also like to express our support for Senate Bill 792 and the regional employment model, whether that's a pilot project, however we work on that one. That's something that we are definitely interested in as well. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Starr?
Thank you. For the panel and maybe for future folks that speak, the bill contemplates a sunset. And as I read it, it says the unemployment rate is 8%. I think it says here in the bill, if I'm not reading it incorrectly. It seems to me that it wasn't very long ago when a particular county government where I live negotiated a tax special tax treatment with a very large employer in our state with an understanding that they wouldn't grow jobs more than an X number. It seems to me, and now we're in the environment that we're in today, where, oh my goodness, we sure could use a lot more jobs. Is 8% the right number, and do we really want to have a process that we can go out and advertise to folks as we got this expedited process, but then someday, you know, who knows, you know, hopefully our unemployment rate will drop to 8%. Hopefully it'll drop a lot lower than that, and then this process goes away. Comments?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, we've worked on that language already. The new number, I think, is 6% in there. There's been a variety of discussions about that, and you're absolutely right that it shouldn't just be some arbitrary thing that we think we've fixed the problem if we're 8% and the national unemployment rate is 5%. You know, I personally wouldn't mind something that was tied to the national and said, if we're above the national, this stays in effect. But I think there was trying to create that certainty that this wasn't a giant bureaucracy that was going to hang out there forever, and it truly is these extraordinary times that are calling for these extraordinary measures, and I would be comfortable with 6%. I think that was a good point that's in the latest draft of the bill, but of course the work group has worked quite diligently on many, many drafts, and Richard Whitman has done a great job in that.
Chair Beyer and Senator Starr, actually one of the things that I said when first coming together with this group was I'd like to see if we can do things that are a good idea anyway, because frankly the land use system gets blamed whether we have a boom or a bust in Oregon for something, and I'd like to look at good ideas for economic development. And in the discussions, there was a lot of discussion about the difficulty of negotiating state agencies when you have multiple state agencies to deal with in citing an industrial user. And if this turns out to be a good way to streamline many state agencies reviewing something, then I hope we're back to you with something that's more permanent. Good. But the interest was, let's see if we've got this right and how it works.
I like that answer.
Thank you.
Senator Drew.
Thank you. Actually, I've done a large development. And I got to tell you, it's extremely frustrating. And what was frustrating, it was something that was alluded to, wetlands mitigation. For that to even get on, you have to deal with the feds, you have to deal with the state, and then I had to deal with the Department of Agriculture just to figure out what was wetlands and what wasn't. So the question being is, the bill can, and I think it's trust me, I think you're going in the right direction here. But there's a lot of relationships with the feds. You got DEQ and EPA. You got Fish and Wildlife Feds. You got Fish and Wildlife State. So, is there anything that we can do, or did you come, to push the relationships even further with the state and the feds? Because a lot of that's redundant, and it is extremely frustrating. I mean, something so simple as we couldn't care less what the wetland was, just tell it was what it is. And you have three different agencies with three different stakes in the ground telling you, no, this is the wetlands.
Maybe. Chair Beyer and Senator Girard, we share that frustration. What we have had conversations about in the work group is what are the protocols, how do we best tackle the very issues that you've just talked about, because from the Port of Portland through the private sector, we've all been dealing with those issues. We haven't found the solution yet. We're working on it, but yes, it has been a part of the discussion, because as this committee has heard me before say, it's wet in Oregon. We should be able to figure this out in a thoughtful way, respecting the environment, but respecting the other needs as well.
Senator Rod, that's one of the discussions of where the idea of the council came from.
That's right.
Getting all of the necessary state agencies in the room at the same time, trying to work that out in an expedited manner. So you may not like the answer you get, but the hope is you'll get an answer quick.
What I was trying to bring a point to is it's not just state agencies.
Yeah.
It's the overlap with the feds, and where we overlap with the feds is where we have the problems, because for some reason they just never seem to agree. and they play good cop, bad cop, and alternate between the two of them.
We can only do what we can do.
That's right.
Further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Clem, would you like to testify?
Oh. Can we get the cross-examine?
Huh? Well, he started this mess, so. Thank you very much for your work, and see where you got us now.
Thank you, Chair Beyer. It's kind of fun to be over in the Senate. I think this is my first appearance in front of a Senate committee. Brian Clem, State Representative from District 21, and I'm I was the chair of the Interim Agriculture Committee, and I, Representative Jensen and I serve as the chairs of the House Ag and Natural Resources now. And as your good chairman indicated, last September or so, we held a hearing in the Interim Agriculture Committee, and I'm sure Chandler's back there somewhere. It's his idea in general that spawned this. He's telling me, you guys are always fighting about Measure 49 and Measure 37, everything else out in the countryside. Why don't you make it a little easier to build in town for those of us who would like to get to work here? And we had a number of other bills that I could see coming. People were telling me about their bills around things related to wetlands and things on standing and all kinds of stuff. And so we had a hearing on the topic, and it was pretty clear there was a lot of opportunity to get some work done to help make development easier in this state. And I had a number of business owners in Portland telling me that they've been trying to site new, in one case it was a grocery store, and there's hundreds of jobs would be available if we could just get this going, and that it was 3 years and counting to try and get this thing built. And so we set up on a work group, and I decided to ask someone over here, Senator Edwards, to join the House Interim Ag Committee Work Group, because at some point I figured we'd like to get you all to sign off on it. Then I largely abandoned ship and sat there while Senator Edwards ran the first several hearings with my staff person, Beth Herzog, who helped staff it, as many of you know. And then I think at some point we got to the need to have not 45 people in the room, even though we did have a lot of items that were consensus points, even without 45. And fortunately, somebody had just won his election here and was a knowledgeable, longtime expert on these issues. And Senator Edwards got your chair involved in helping seal the deal, because if you had just left it up to me, it'd probably still be in negotiations. So I want to, and and Representative Gilliam was in there the entire time, sometimes by phone, sometimes in person, but he was thoroughly engaged. So the House is anxiously awaiting reception of this bill once you get through the testimony and see if you need amendments beyond what you've already got. We're very excited to partner with the Senate on getting this done. None of us can add our names to co-sponsorship until you've voted on it on the floor, but we're all excited to pile on and try and claim some credit somewhere in the mix, I can tell you. Somebody over here on the left, I did get to become a chief co-sponsor, I believe, with some arm twisting, and I'm working hard to try and get some kumbaya moments on land use, which is not always the easiest thing to do, but with the good graces of the chair here, we'll end up with a pretty good bill that will help a lot of Oregonians get to work. That's all I really have for you.
Now you know who to blame. Senator Rod.
Thank you, Chair. I have to say I work with Brian on several issues, and it's always fun, and we always seem to come to some commonality, and so it's always a pleasure to have you over here. But I do have a question. And that was, it was just what I asked the last group. It's really frustrating for developers when you have a state agency and a federal agency overseeing the same darn thing, and they can't agree. And that happens a lot. Now, is there? I would like to see sometime maybe that if that's the case, where a DSL disagrees with the Corps of Army Engineers, that the state agency backs off because we don't have any dictate over the feds. And the same goes for fish and wildlife. Believe it or not, that's a problem when it comes to what's a fish-bearing stream. You know, and I'm not saying one favors one way and one favors the other, but it's extremely frustrating that we do have overlaps in all these, a lot of different parts of the land use process, and it is that overlap that really causes a lot of delays, as well as, the infighting that goes within the state agencies.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Girard, one of the things we did in that initial process was set out all the things we thought we could deal with and then took the ones we didn't think we could off the table. I think that since you're the chair of the Senate Agriculture Committee that doesn't exist, you could either take it up in your,
office. I'd love to be the chair.
Or we could look into some of what you're talking about in the House Agriculture Committee, because a lot of these things are something that farmers talk about, and I'm open to doing more exploration. I don't think we're going to probably get into that too much in this bill, but we'll have hearings. It might just be you and I. I can appoint another committee. It'll be you and me, and we'll sit here all night long getting some of Chandler's other people up here to talk about it.
I got a comment. So for the audience that always thinks that Republicans and Democrats don't get along, Brian and Senator Edwards were out last night at Da Vinci, so we're trying to solve the world's ills. That's right. We're discussing.
I don't think we'll get into that.
Thank you very much,
please.
Representative. We'll let you go back to work.
Thank you.
I've been working hard.
Let's see. Going on down the list here, John Mullis and Alana. A little labor perspective.
Sure. Thank you so much, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. My name is Ilana Guinea. I'm with the Oregon AFL-CIO. And I want to start by saying that we support this bill. We really like a lot of the concepts in this bill. We are glad to be part of the work group that you have been hearing about today. As I've said to many of you this session and to many of your colleagues, our number one goal right now is job creation. We can't do anything else until we get people in this state back to work. And one piece of the job creation puzzle is ensuring that employers have room to site, to grow, and to employ Oregonians. That's what we're trying to do with this bill. To rebuild our economy in the long run, we have to focus on our industrial lands. You've heard from other speakers, other people testifying today about the importance of industrial jobs as a base for high-wage employment, the spin-off job creation from industrial jobs, and a bill like this that can really help those jobs come to fruition more quickly and more easily is absolutely necessary to get our economy going again. We know that there's going to be a long process of amendments to get this bill right. That's already started within the work group. You've heard about some of those changes today. We hope that as you look at those amendments and as you look at the bill and as we move forward, you keep a couple of things in mind, though. It is crucial that we ensure that the jobs we're creating with this bill are high-wage jobs, and it's crucial that we ensure that we're creating enough jobs to really make a difference and help our economy. It's also incredibly important to us that we make sure we're accessing the right lands with this bill, and that the words that we're using, the definitions that we're using, allow us to get at those truly regionally significant pieces of land that have qualities that make them different from everything else and that have qualities that make them of the utmost importance for our economy. I don't want to repeat things that other people have said, so I'll leave it at that, but I'm happy to answer any questions, and I thank you for hearing this bill today.
Thank you. John?
Good afternoon, Senator Beyer, members of the committee. My name is John Molis. I'm the Executive Secretary for the Oregon State Building and Construction Trades Council. I very much appreciate the committee taking the time to work on this very important issue. I'm also a member of the work group. It's been a very interesting learning experience from me, and you've already heard from a number of people today that have been involved in this this issue for far longer than I have and are far more knowledgeable about this very complex issue. So I'm not going to repeat a lot of what they have said or go into great detail, but I did want to go on record with the State Council in favor of these efforts. Everybody knows the tough economy that we've been in the last couple of years. The building trades have been hit particularly hard. Our members, on average, have been unemployed at about 35% for the last 2 years. I was at Governor Kitzhaber's speech before the City Club last week, and one of his first comments was, we want everyone to know that Oregon is open for business. And I think these efforts that you're undertaking today with 766 and the other bills help send that message that Oregon is open for business, and we can want to rebuild our manufacturing industry and put our building trades members back to work. So thanks very much for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, John. Any questions, this panel?
Well, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Dan Iceberg and Tom Armstrong. Eisenbeis. Dan, I really messed up your name. I apologize.
It's been done before.
me too.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Daniel Eisenbeis with the City of Portland. With me here today is Tom Armstrong from our Bureau of Planning and Sustainability to help address any questions that you may have. I want to begin by acknowledging the leadership of Senator Beyer on this issue. The City of Portland supports the objectives in Senate Bill 766 to both expedite permitting for particularly important employment projects, as well as to protect prime industrial lands zoned for industrial use from conflicting uses and inappropriate conversion. That said, we also want to voice concern that the bill not be amended to preempt a local government's authority to adopt development standards. The City of Portland has long been at the forefront of protecting industrial lands. In 1980, we were the first city in the nation to adopt an industrial sanctuary. We've also adopted measures to limit retail uses in industrial areas, and we've supported Metro's adoption of rules to help protect industrial lands from division as well. And we believe that these provisions offer a potential framework for protecting lands in other parts of Oregon. In terms of the Economic Recovery Review Council, we're supportive of amendments that the work group is looking at to focus the authority of the council on consolidating state permit review with local land use review, those decisions that are subject to appeal. We want to note some concern about the decisions of the review council being binding on local governments for other kinds of development standards, like building codes, streets, sewers, that sort of thing, that are typically not subject to appeal. In terms of the second half of the bill dealing with designation of regionally significant industrial lands in the Portland metro area, there is a regional designation for such lands, and we've been supportive of that framework. To the degree that this bill is focused, as we understand it, on preventing conversion of those lands and addressing conflicting uses, we're quite supportive. That said, there is some language in the bill that we feel is ambiguous, and there are potential amendments that would require mitigation by a local government for any kind of development standards that affect employment potential. We feel that this is too broad and would put local government in an impossible situation that could also have adverse impacts on actual development in these areas. Development standards can include things like parking requirements, setbacks, building heights, as well as environmental standards. A mitigation requirement that is tied to development standards would disrupt our ability to balance competing interests and to comply with other state and federal planning mandates. Local governments such as Portland have to comply with directives from the Federal Emergency Management Agency regarding floodplains, Endangered Species Act listings, and Clean Water Act regulations, just to name a few. We're concerned that requiring mitigation or otherwise preempting local governments' development standards could effectively win a battle for development interests to ultimately lose the war, in the sense that these proposals could leave local governments vulnerable to lawsuits, but also cause delay in permitting by federal entities in particular. We've found that at the local level, it is not our local permitting that holds up projects. It's state and federal permitting that typically takes much longer. We believe that our land use review process for projects that's laid out in the expedited portion for the regionally significant industrial areas is typically on par, if not faster, than the timelines that are spelled out in the bill. But there, we don't want to make the mistakes that have been made in some other places outside of Oregon, where federal agencies have required local governments to do things and development has come to a halt. So we want to voice support for the underlying objectives of the bill, but very much caution you to not expand the scope of a bill in a way that undercuts the interests that we think we all share. Thank you for the opportunity to comment.
Senator. Thank you. Were you a member of the work group? Or was the City of Portland a member of the work group?
The City of Portland has attended the last two meetings of the work group, but we were not involved in discussions prior to that of the smaller group. We were involved in the initial development within the urban growth boundary work group started by Representative Clem and Representative Gilliam and Senator Edwards.
Senator Gerard?
Yeah, thanks, Chair Barr. I have to tell you, it's kind of disheartening because everyone else has talked about cutting through the red tape, and you want to keep the red tape there, right? Do you want development in Portland, or do you not? If you don't, then let's take it out of the bill. I mean, that's just my own personal feeling.
May I respond?
Certainly.
Senator Beyer, Senator Gerard, I think part of the caution that we're trying to offer is that what's perceived as potentially cutting red tape at the local level could cause more red tape at the federal level in particular.
Sure.
Yes, Tom Armstrong with the City of Portland, Chair Beyer, Senator Gerard. I guess what I would add and where our position is with respect to local environmental regulations, to the extent that they create a picture or a certainty, a larger picture for those federal agencies on protection of the resources, that lifts a burden on any individual project, and that absent those, or then the federal agency sort of has to step up their game and protect every last resource on an individual case-by-case basis. So that, and I guess what we've found in sort of our reviews as we were looking at it, and as Dan suggested, is that, you know, our environmental reviews are the average time that it takes to get through those reviews are actually more on par on 88 days than the 120 days or 119 days provided in the legislation.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Pat Rebella and Bill Reed. Chair Beyer and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to present testimony on behalf of the City of Hillsborough. My name is Pat Rebella, Planning Director for the City, and we have with me Bill Reed from Johnson Reed. The reason Bill is here is, as part of our testimony, we submitted some technical information, and he's the author of that, so should you have any questions about that material, he's here to answer the questions. What we want to do is express our support for Senate Bill 66, and we'd like to ask that the committee consider expanding its application to not only areas that are planned and zoned for our industrial uses, but future designated areas, growth areas that are also earmarked or targeted for industrial growth and jobs growth, especially in the Portland metro region. We think that we'd like to ask the committee to consider that. If that's done, that would, at least in our area, would have even greater potential for producing jobs out in the state and in the Portland region. We support especially the proposals for regionally significant industrial areas. We think that with these modifications to the bill, we have clearly in the Portland region very good candidates for those designations in these future growth areas. So if we'd like to help in any way possible going forward in terms of making the bill helping the bill go in this direction. And I guess I'll stop at that because lots have been said today and I don't want to repeat what's been said. But if there's any questions, I'd be glad to answer them. Thank you. Just here for questions?
Just here for questions, okay. And technical assistance, yes.
Senator Shaw, do you have any?
I wouldn't hurt my feelings at all if Mr. Reed just did a high-level on the document that they provided us. Please don't read it, but just give it a quick snapshot of what it means and what it says.
Sure. Chair Beyer, Senator Starr, I'd be happy to. Basically, the document before you outlines...
Sir, could I ask you to put your name on the record?
Oh, sure, no problem. I apologize. Bill Reed with Johnson Reed, 319 Southwest Washington in Portland, economic consulting firm. We've also been lucky to assist other jurisdictions that testified here today on these very issues. So very active on the issue of industrial land statewide in partnership with DLCD. And the local jurisdictions. But basically the information before you here that we've provided is that as part of the city's planning process for the next 20 and 50 years, as part of the recent urban reserves designation process, when the city was interested in understanding how competitive it was and how competitive the Silicon Forest Western Washington County subregion is, moving forward in attracting the key high-tech industry cluster employers that that part of the state has had a successful track record with. It's a very specific mix of industries, high-tech, biopharma, biotech, and more recently solar panel manufacturer, very, very well-respected, high-paying international firms. And the main finding here is that, and what hopefully won't be lost in the discussion about the bills before you, is that jobs adding jobs is important, but what we're also really talking about with regard to industrial land are the needs of individual businesses when they look to locating in Oregon. And for this information specifically, Western Washington County, high-tech firms need very specific sites and very specific site needs of size so that they can rapidly expand over time with minimal hassle and difficulty. And more importantly, with regard to the city of Hillsboro and other cities in Oregon, dealing with high-tech firms, specifically the city of Hillsboro, it's competing against Austin, Texas, Raleigh-Durham, North Carolina, Colorado Springs, Denver area, a number of other markets nationwide that offer a number of different sites that are ready to be developed within 180 days of application. And those competitive markets for these high-tech industries offer a number of these sites for selection for firms to take a look at, to come to the area, take a look at 3, 4, 10, 12, 15 sites in order that they can find the right site and come to that area. And the primary finding here for you is that within Western Washington County, specifically in the city of Hillsboro, as opposed to all of the other markets that have no less than 11 development-ready sites of at least 50 acres, the Silicon Forest in Oregon only has one site. It doesn't have more than one to offer for selection for firms. It has one site only. And what we find is that the way other economic development entities elsewhere in the country that are competing against Oregon and specifically the Silicon Forest here, if there isn't any selection to offer these firms, no matter how high the quality of life is, no matter what the incentives may be, the partnership that the local jurisdictions or regional jurisdictions offer those firms to get infrastructure in place for them, if there are no sites to choose from, the rest of it doesn't matter until after they know they have sites they can look at. So that's the main finding, is that there's really only one site at this point in Silicon Forest, and that's highly uncompetitive in the current market.
And Mr. Chairman, I just have a follow-up question. Based on the testimony that you heard from Mr. Whitman about, and you've been very involved in the urban growth, the urban reserve, rural reserves debate, and the proposed metro urban growth boundary expansion, in light of that, would Senate Bill 266, as it is, help Hillsboro post the urban growth boundary expansion?
Absolutely, Senator. It would be, especially as this is why we were especially interested in the issue of the regionally significant industrial areas, because once those, for example, those areas are brought identified as urban reserves for future employment, it a lot of policy questions about should it be used that way, can it be served, can it be governed, all of those things would have been resolved at the region level. So what the bill presents through this structure of reserve, regionally significant areas and projects of state significance and expedited permits is a way to provide a lot of certainty about those areas being able to accommodate new companies within a very, very reasonable time frame. So we see the great potential in terms of this bill and its tools helping the Silicon Forest, the Portland region, and especially these traded sectors to continue to compete in the global market. And as we said in our testimony, these are the sectors that are there now that are in many respects economic drivers for the state economy, for the regional economy, for the local economy. And what we're trying to do, and this bill presents an opportunity to help them grow organically and diversify and become an even further stronger base for all three economies. So we see a lot of potential in this bill, and we hope that it can morph into a bill that also addresses those needs.
I have a question. Mr. Reed, is Johnson Reed a siting firm or economic research?
More economic, land use economic consulting firm. We do development feasibility as well as employment land analysis, economic opportunity analyses for different jurisdictions statewide. So We don't actually do the site selection process.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any more questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's see. John Williams and Dick Benner. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hi. Thank you, sir. Senator Beyer, Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is John Williams. I'm Deputy Director for the Planning and Development Department at Metro. With me is Dick Benner, distinguished attorney from our agency as well. Also here to testify, obviously, on 766, and we were part of the work group that you've heard mention of before, similar to the City of Portland. Although Metro has no direct role in permitting, we're supportive of the concepts in this bill. In fact, the Metro Council has adopted much of similar measures to what's in Senate Bill 766. Working with our regional partners, we've defined the region's employment and industrial areas. We've designated regionally significant employment areas in the region, and we're regretting the fact that we didn't trademark the name. It appears it may have some legs here. But the regional significant industrial areas in our region are those areas with the best combination of site attributes and including transportation to bring in large employers. In all of the areas that I've mentioned, we have protections in place that local jurisdictions must comply with. They have complied with them. Just to call out a couple, for example, in regionally significant industrial areas, cities and counties must limit the size and location of new commercial and retail uses. They must prohibit siting new schools, places of assembly, parks, and they must limit the division of parcels 50 acres and larger. And it's that last point that I think perhaps you have some interest in. It's particularly important. Over the last year or two, our region has spent quite a bit of time discussing these large sites, the 50-acre and up sites. We've identified that over the upcoming 20 years, we have a shortage of 50-acre and larger sites in the region for traded sector industries. And I'm sorry Senator Starr isn't here, because I think, responsive to some of his questions earlier, it's going to be a major part of our work program over the next year to work with cities and counties, economic development folks, to identify new opportunity sites that are out there, to take a look at the barriers that exist to developing them, find the tools that are needed to get those sites market ready. And I want to emphasize those sites could be inside and outside the urban growth boundary. We recognize that both of those are going to make up the sites that we utilize in the future in the region. And we also want to work on creating a way to replenish the inventory of sites that our region has when existing sites do develop. And I also want to mention our council has announced an intent to add several hundred acres of land suitable for large lot development near Hillsborough into our urban growth boundary. And we intend to make that decision later this year. You heard from Richard Whitman that that's predicated on the adoption of urban and rural reserves, which we're looking forward to. Metro will also be doing a number of other things. We're working on implementing our freight plan, which was recently adopted, targeting brownfields, looking at workforce access to jobs. So it's all part of a comprehensive picture. One thing that I would like to mention, a common theme in all this work, is our ability to invest in these areas. Like elsewhere, I'm sure you're hearing from many places around the state that have a limited ability to fund infrastructure investments. We've documented an infrastructure funding shortfall running into the billions of dollars in our region. And it makes all kinds of development, wherever you're looking, very difficult to make it happen. And so, no matter how much land we have designated for job creation, we are intending to work, and I know you are as well, working on tools for the local jurisdictions to be able to invest in these areas to make them market ready, to support private sector job creation. We know that's what we're all after here. So it'll be a major focus of work in our region. We do have some technical pieces that probably need to be addressed as work goes on. I won't spend your time on those today. We're happy to be part of that group. Dick and I are happy to take any questions you have. That's pretty much what I wanted to say. I think we need to cover anything else.
Thank you. Appreciate your help to date in pointing these out. And any ideas, you know, that's what we're looking for.
Okay.
Including that. Financing is always an issue, and I think it's one of the things I know we've talked about in the workforce is, can't do everything at once. We may have to make some tough priority decisions. Questions? Thank you, Brenner. You can be awfully quiet, Mr. Brenner.
I'm very comfortable being quiet.
Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Bruce Miller.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Miller. I'm Senior Staff Counsel in the Office for the State Court Administrator. Chief Justice DeMunis and Chief Judge Brewer know very well that economic development is a priority for the state, and they want you to know that the courts stand ready and willing to do their best to help you where we can. I'd like to mention that Senate Bill 766 is not the only economic development bill in the building that involves the courts, and I expect there may be others that come along as well. On Senate Bill 766, there are four areas that involve the courts. The first is there's an opportunity for Court of Appeals review of decisions made by the Economic Recovery Council. There is circuit court mandamus for the circumstances where a local government doesn't meet the statutory deadline set out in the bill. There is Court of Appeals review of those mandamus proceedings. And there is expedited Court of Appeals review of decisions made by local referees on disputes over the permits issued. Under the expedited review, parties will have 21 days to submit their briefs from the time petition is filed. Oral argument must be heard within 49 days, and a decision must be issued within 91 days. We are studying the bill to determine the extent of any fiscal impact that this may have. I'm sure you all know this, but legislation can affect the courts in a variety of ways. One is it can add new cases on top of an existing caseload. It can require expedited review in an existing caseload, and it can add new cases with expedited review on top of the normal workload. In 766, we appear to have a mix of all of those. There are a couple different ways that courts can deal with this. One is to delay work on other case types. Another is to seek funding for additional judges and staff. To that end, we have a policy option package and Senate Bill 388 to add another panel to the Court of Appeals, another three-judge panel. We understand that that's a difficult request given the current economic situation, but we wanted to at least start the discussion on that. The request is based on a study done by the National Center for State Courts that indicates that the Court of Appeals needs a minimum of 2 to 3 additional panels to process the caseload that it has in the manner in which it is supposed to. It needs one panel just to tread water to keep going the way it is today. So please understand and please know that the courts are committed to help, but please, to the extent that you can, keep Senate Bill 388 in mind. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? We just want to keep the courts really close to this. Mr. Sellinger and Mr. Kafoury.
Good afternoon, Senator Beyer and members of the committee. My name is Bob Sellinger. I'm the Conservation Director for the Portland Audubon Society. Like most organizations, we've been affected by the recession, and we're deeply aware of its impacts and concerned about it. And there are elements of this bill that we can support. We do support preventing conversion of industrial lands through new zoning. We also support streamlining, coordinating of permitting at the state, local, and federal levels. And I'm glad Senator Girard brought that up today. In fact, you know, in the recent river plan that was so controversial, it had both of those elements in there, and we were the ones that pushed for the multi-level coordination. We believe that's essential, and I think bringing in the feds, because the feds are often the slowest part of the process. However, we do feel that this bill goes too far, and we can't support it in its current form. We believe that it elevates Goal 9 above other goals, specifically 3, 5, and 15, and it undermines our land use system. We would note that no environmental groups were in the working group, and that's a disappointment to us because it seems like a lot of this bill is actually aimed at environmental regulations. And we think it's important that if you're going to have a working group, that environmental groups be involved. Thousand Friends is sometimes used as a surrogate for the environmental community. I have great respect for Thousand Friends, and we see them as an important friend and ally. But at the same time, they have a different perspective than habitat and wildlife-based conservation groups. And we think it's important that you have some of those at the table as well. Many of our industrial lands, when I think of the city of Portland Industrial Harbor, for example, are in critical environmental areas. River drains 11,500 square miles. And we do an incredible amount of work and make an incredible amount of investment upstream to restore salmon populations. But every single one of those fish has to go through the Portland Harbor. And the investment that we make upstream is undermined by the condition of those last several miles. It's also Portland's access to the river in many places. The river serves that purpose as well for recreation and access. These lands also have impacts on the surrounding community. I know that many people are concerned with the Port of Portland expansion, for example, that they're going to be bringing in coal. For example, on West Hayden Island, and there's a real concern about the impacts on the local community and making sure that those are sufficiently addressed. We passed out comments, and those go into our specific concerns, but I just want to put a few themes on the table right now. We do support preventing conversion of lands through rezoning industrial lands, but we think this bill actually goes further, and we see it as potentially restricting other things like environmental overlays, stormwater protections, and those kinds of things. We think that needs to be clarified to make sure that it doesn't actually do that. We want to point out that it's important that the local jurisdictions be able not only to meet federal regulations, but to get ahead of them. We know that once a species is listed, it's much more expensive and has a huge impact on the local community to deal with that listing. And fish aren't the only species on the radar screen. There are also bird species, that, for example, that in the near future that could dramatically affect Portland Harbor. And it's important that we get ahead of that curve and be proactive rather than react. Finally, public process. We believe public process does matter, and the local community should have a voice. On the local river plan hearings, hundreds and hundreds of people wrote in and came out because they wanted a voice over what happens in their river. And so we are concerned about the limited appeals, the lack of hearings. As we read this legislation, the appeals would exclude groups like Audubon from being able to be part of those appeals. It's limited to the folks that get notice, and we are not included in that. So that's a real restricted opportunity for appeal. And I would note, by the way, that we have never litigated against development in the Portland Harbor, not once. But I think it's important that we preserve that right. Even the way the bill was rolled out is of concern to us. Like I said, environmental groups were not part of this process. And when the governor came to Portland to announce it, the city of Portland wasn't even aware that it was happening. And so I think making sure that local communities really are involved and really do have a voice, and I would suggest that if you're going to have this supersiting panel, that you actually do reserve a seat on it for local jurisdictions to actually be at the table. I'll just end by noting that we are concerned about the recession. We're impacted like everybody else. But the recession will not go on forever. The impacts of this bill potentially will. And so we appreciate your hearing our concerns today.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Mr. Kafoury.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Stephen Kafoury. Although I like and respect Bob Salinger, I want to be clear, we are not a panel. I'm representing today the Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association, which has over 950 members. Because our members include state and local planners, independent consultants representing developers, lay members of local planning commissions, land use lawyers who represent both sides of planning conflicts, our board is necessarily quite cautious about taking positions on legislation. Our goal as an organization is to ensure that good planning principles are used in making public policy. Mr. Chair, you've heard a lot of people come up here and say, we really like the principles of this bill, but, and they go through a long list of problems. And I won't say that. I'll just say that we don't like the bill. We obviously are concerned about economic development. We're obviously concerned about finding jobs, and we're obviously concerned about supply of buildable land for industrial purposes. But we think this bill is based on a number of false assumptions.
The first false assumption is that a shortage exists of industrial land. Every time the state enters recession, policymakers respond as if we are in a supply-limited situation rather than a demand-limited situation. In the past, and I've been here to watch this, we've responded with shovel-ready industrial site certifications, abandoned mill legislation, and now we're responding with expedited permitting. The template from this bill comes from changes made to ORS 197.365 in 1995, the most notably unsuccessful, unused, expedited land division. Another new process was supposed to make things quicker and easier, and now lies in the graveyard of bad ideas, along with other fixes that sounded great in committee and made people feel like they were doing something, but ultimately made no changes. Increasing the amount or availability of industrial land will not increase the market demand for that land. Second false assumption is the lack of raw land is the problem. In fact, sufficient raw land is available. However, land with utilities and transportation access is not. Planning and regulation, even with expedited permitting, cannot turn long-term land supply into serviced land available for development. You just heard Metro say that they have a $3 billion unmet infrastructure need. That's why 95% of the land that's been brought into their UGB since 1979 has not been serviced or permitted for development. The third thing, false assumption, is that local governments have been lax in finding and designating land for industrial purposes, requiring the state to step in. Present law requires local governments to provide a long-term supply by planning for 20 years and by regulation, which industrial uses are allowed outright. They have many built-in incentives, the desire for local jobs and the need for permit revenue to maintain these inventories. Fourth false assumption is that delays in permitting process are a problem that this bill will solve. The statutes requiring actions on permits within 120 days are already applicable to local governments and are quicker than the process designed in Senate Bill 766. If there's a problem with permitting, we suggest the legislature put 120-day decision limits on state agencies that issue permits. Next one, the level of bureaucracy at the state level. Another level of bureaucracy at the state level is necessary and desirable. We local planners are the ones who must pick up the pieces, reconcile the vague terms, issue the planning permits, and deal with the disappointed economic expectations of those who choose to use this new process. The ERRC will not be familiar with local conditions, nor economic realities, nor local plans and codes, but must respond quickly to the demands of applicants. How will they set up fees for all classes or permits? It seems that shortfalls will be taken from existing agency budgets to fund this. We also note that local governments must determine whether an application is complete, prepare the notice, evaluate the comments, and issue a decision within 63 days without any fee permit of revenues. All this would occur without any oral hearing, all that give and take of interactive discussion that somehow seems to get in the way when citizens get involved. The only people who get to appeal are governments, recognized planning groups, and those who live within 100 feet. The Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association has always supported public involvement so legitimate environmental or property rights interests can be involved in land use planning decisions. Additionally, we see serious flaws, procedural flaws, that have no requirement that the evidence for a decision be sufficient and that LUBRA review the decision. And that we've heard the problems with the appellate courts from the people who just talked. There are plans, there are things that could be done to assist in getting land developed. These cost money. Cleaning up brownfields. There's one bill that is in the House that is taking a small step in the direction. We hope you take a look at it, Representative Lou Frederick. Requiring state agencies to move on permits, funding infrastructure, requiring the state to move more diligently on prohibiting conversion of industrial lands to other uses, which you've heard about all today. Those are hard to do. This is easy to pass, and we suggest that you don't, and take a look at the hard solutions, not the easy ones.
Mr. Scafori, I appreciate the position of the association, but I would note for the record that there were a number of local land use planners that had been involved in the process of developing this legislation. And a lot of it arose out of concerns raised by local governments about not being able to move quick enough in the process. And the other thing I would point out is that the designation of sites under here requires the participation and support of a local government, or it doesn't happen. So it's not like the local governments are being run over the top of, and at least conceptually there. So appreciate it. Other questions? Thank you very much, gentlemen. I'm at the end of the list. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on this, on these bills? Seeing none, I will close the, got a bunch here, close the public hearings on Senate Bill 771, 776, 476, and 792.
766.
I said that wrong. And I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 704. Let me get to you. Go ahead, Richard.
Thank you, Chair. Senate Bill 704 exempts persons performing work for purposes of agricultural drainage, agricultural trenching, or agricultural irrigation from licensure as a construction contractor. Exempts persons from performing work on forest lands for which notice of operation has been filed from licensure as a construction contractor. We heard this bill on March 1st, and the committee adopted two amendments. One that adds an emergency clause and one that adds persons who construct agricultural fences to the list of exempt from construction contractors. We have no revenue and minimal expenditure on the bill, including the adopted amendments.
Okay, the chair moves Senate Bill 706 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the bill. Seeing no discussion, is there any opposition? Seeing none, Senate Bill 704, as amended, is passed the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Did we pass the amendment yet?
I think you already did.
Okay.
You already adopted it.
Would you like to carry this one? I'm up. Senator Girard will carry. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 518. Louise, thank you for indulging us.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Louise Soliday, Director of the Department of State Lands. And if you'll indulge me for a second, Mr. Chair, I want to just update Senator Girard on some things that have changed since he did his development. We no longer have dueling wetland delineations between the Corps and the Department of State Lands. The Corps defers to the Department of State Lands on those wetland delineations and accepts the ones that we concur in. And secondly, we no longer have dueling mitigation obligations. The Corps and the department and the applicant now work on a single mitigation plan that works for both the agencies and the applicant. So we are addressing some of those issues that were a problem in the past, and hopefully they're not a problem anymore. With respect to Senate Bill 518, there are two issues that Senate Bill 518 attempts to address. One is an issue where we got authority in the 2007 legislative session to issue something called a general permit. And the general permit allows us to issue a permit for a number of activities that are similar in nature, that have a known and expected outcome, but that have more than a minimal impact on the environment. And it's a way for us to streamline the process for activities that are repetitive in nature. We know what they are. We know what the impacts are. We can issue a general permit that allows all of those activities to go forward under a single permit. It can be in a geographic area. It can be to a particular organization. It can be a statewide general permit. When the legislation was adopted in 2007, it directed that we adopt those by rulemaking. And rulemaking doesn't work well with a permit application. So what we're asking in this bill, or what's asked in this bill, is that we be able to skip several of the steps in the normal rulemaking process. We would go through a public comment period, as we do with all of our permits. We would continue to use our removal fill technical advisory committee to get input on those general permits, as we have done with the ones that we've issued to date. But it's a way for us to move those permits through the process faster than we can under a normal rulemaking process.
That's good.
The idea is to expedite those general permits through the process. The second issue that's addressed by this bill in the second section is, under current state law, when someone is doing their mitigation project by paying into the state's removal fill mitigation fund, we have a one-size-fits-all payment plan, and that is we determine a statewide average that is being charged by the bankers around the state, and that's the fee that everybody has to pay if that's the way they do the mitigation. That one-size-fits-all is not fair to our customers, and the reason it's not fair is land values are very different in different parts of the state, and so the price of doing mitigation in the metro area is more expensive than the price of doing mitigation in other areas of the valley and other areas of the state. Currently, everybody has to pay that statewide average. We'd like to be able to look at using a regional average so that in areas where land values are less, the cost of doing mitigation is less, the price that people have to pay to do that mitigation, to make that mitigation payment, would be less. In areas where the land values are higher and the cost of doing mitigation is higher, that payment would be higher. We also want to be able to look at whether those wetlands are poor functioning wetlands that are being impacted or high value wetlands that are being impacted, and be able to price differently based on the value, the functions of those wetlands that are being impacted, so that somebody who's impacting poor value wetlands pays less than somebody who's impacting higher value wetlands. So the goal here is to be fairer to our customers in terms of how much they have to pay when they're mitigating into the removal fill mitigation fund.
Very good.
And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? You must have a question.
Well, I do. It's late, but...
But it's after 5.
It is after 5, and this is a $64,000 question. The feds have, you know, they have an agency that oversees all this, so I'm trying to justify the existence of DSL to even do mitigation and delineation of wetlands. When you have the Corps, that doesn't cost the state any money. Care to comment on that?
So, Mr. Chair and Senator Girod, as you know, since the Clean Water Act passed, the state and the federal government have had dual permitting roles. So, Section 404 of the Clean Water Act and the Removal Fill Law, which was first passed in 1967, require similar permits for similar activities. There are some differences in terms of the jurisdictional areas that are covered. The definition of waters of the state is different than the definition of the waters of the U.S. that are covered under the Clean Water Act. I will say there are differences in approaches to enforcement of the removal fill statutes as opposed to the 404 permitting. I think the question is a legitimate question. We have, you'll notice if you read our statutes, we have a dual set of statutes. So every section has a second section that's the same number. The language is slightly different. That second set of statutes was adopted several years ago by the legislature, and it was adopted with the intent that at some point the state would assume the 404 core program so that there would be a single permitting process for removal fill activities as opposed to a dual permitting process. We've been hesitant to go down that road to assume the 404 program because it comes with the need to do consultation under the Endangered Species Act. You can't dodge that bullet by assuming the 404 program. We have been working with the Corps to line up our programs better through the use of these general permits and regional general permits that are identical in nature in terms of the activities that are covered, the conditions that folks have to meet, so that when people are doing a lot of these activities, a lot of the activities that used to require individual permits no longer do. They require notification to both agencies, and then you can go out and do those activities. But I think the question that you ask is, it's a fair question about, we do have dual permitting process, both at the federal level and at the state level. The department, it's one of the programs the Department of State Lands has. It's not, in fact, it's not even our core program. Our core program is managing lands to finance public education in the state of Oregon. But I think, the question you ask is a fair conversation to have.
Louise, from talking with people recently, I used to share Fred's concern, but the impression I have from people who've done it recently is that the Corps is deferring more to DSL.
Mr. Chair, I would say that that's true. They still have a separate permitting responsibility, and it comes with the ESA consultation, something that we don't have to go through as a state. I think it's fair to say that we are coordinating much more closely with the Corps. We are trying to not give two different messages to the applicants who are coming in the door. We have a joint application process, so the same application goes to both agencies. We are sharing the delineation work. We are sharing the mitigation planning efforts. And for the most part, I think there's still a frustration that people have to go through both processes very clearly. And I think if you talk to our customers, there's some people who would prefer to go through the core process. There's some people who would prefer to go through the DSL process. And it depends on perspective and experiences in the past. But I would say that the core and the department are working much more closely together than they ever have in trying to make the process as seamless as possible for our customers.
It's 5 o'clock.
It's 5 o'clock. Anything on this end? Okay. Thank you very much, Louise. I have no one else signed up. Excuse me. No one else signed up. Does anybody else wish to testify? Seeing none, we do not have fiscals on this, so we can't move the bill. So we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 518. Is there anything else for the committee?
Oh, there is.
Uh-oh.
Just got this text message. Excuse me. Just got this email regarding Representative Gabby Giffords. Gabby plans to be at the April 19th launch of the Space Shuttle Endeavor that will be commanded by
her husband.
That's good news.
That's good. For those who don't know who she is, she was the congresswoman wounded in Tucson. We are adjourned.